Burning tobacco could travel a long way, and Grigori could not be sure how close the man was. Ahead and above he saw reflected sunlight. He crept upward, ready to fire. The light was coming through a glassless window. The sniper was not there. Grigori climbed farther and saw light again. The smell of smoke grew stronger. Was it his imagination, or could he sense the presence of the sniper just a little farther around the curve of the stairwell? And if so, could the man sense him? He heard a sharp intake of breath. It shocked him so much that he almost pulled the trigger. Then he realized it was the noise a man made when inhaling smoke. A moment later, he heard the softer, satisfied sound of the smoker blowing out. He hesitated. He did not know which way the sniper was looking, or where his gun might be pointing. He wanted to hear the rifle fire again, for that would tell him that the sniper's attention was directed outward. Waiting might mean another death, another Yakov or Varya bleeding on the cold cobblestones. On the other hand, if Grigori failed now, how many more people would be brought down by the sniper this afternoon? Grigori forced himself to be patient. It was like being on the battlefield. You did not rush to save a wounded comrade and thereby sacrifice your life. You took chances only when the reasons were overwhelming. He heard another intake of breath, followed by a long exhalation, and a moment later a crushed cigarette stub came down the staircase, bouncing off the wall and landing at his feet. There was the sound of a man shifting position in a confined space. Then Grigori heard a low muttering, the words sounding mostly like imprecations.
Swine. Revolutionaries. Stinking Jews. Diseased whores. Retards.
The sniper was winding himself up to kill again. If Grigori could stop him now, it would save at least one life. He went up a step. The muttering continued.
Kettle. Slavs. Thieves and criminals.
The voice was vaguely familiar, and Grigori wondered if this was a man he had met before. He took another step, and saw the man's feet, shod in shiny new police pattern black leather boots. They were small feet. The sniper was a diminutive man. He was down on one knee, the most stable position for shooting. Grigori could now see that he had positioned himself inside one of the corner turrets, so that he could fire in three different directions. One more step, Grigori thought, and I will be able to shoot him dead. He took another step, but tension caused him to miss his footing. He stumbled, fell, and dropped his gun. It hit the stone step with a clang. The sniper uttered a loud, frightened curse and looked around. With astonishment, Grigori recognized him as Pinsky's sidekick, Ilya Koslov. Grigori grabbed for his dropped gun and missed. The revolver fell down the stone staircase with agonizing slowness, one step at a time, until it came to rest well out of reach. Kozlov began to turn, but he could not do so quickly from his kneeling position. Grigori regained his balance and went up another step. Kozlov tried to swing his rifle around. It was the standard Mosin Nagant, but with a telescope attached. It was well over a yard long, even without the bayonet, and Kozlov could not bring it to bear fast enough. Moving quickly, Grigori got close, so that the barrel of the rifle struck his left shoulder. Kozlov pulled the trigger uselessly, and a bullet ricocheted around the curved inside wall of the stairwell. Kozlov sprang to his feet with surprising agility. He had a small head and a mean face, and some part of Grigori's mind guessed he had to become a sniper to get revenge on all the bigger boys and girls who had ever pushed him around. Grigori got his hands on the rifle, and the two men struggled for possession, face to face in the cramped little turret next to the glassless window. Grigori heard excited shouting and guessed they must be visible to people on the street. Grigori was bigger and stronger, and knew that he would win possession of the gun. Kozlov realized it too, and suddenly let go. Grigori staggered back. In a flash, the policeman drew his short wooden club and struck out, hitting Grigori on the head. For a moment, Grigori saw stars. In a blur, he saw Kozlov raise the club again. He lifted the rifle, and the club landed on the barrel. Before the policeman could strike again, Grigori dropped the gun, grabbed the front of Kozlov's coat with both hands, and lifted him. The man was slight, and his weight was little. Grigori held him off the floor for a moment. Then with all his might, he threw him out of the window. Kozlov seemed to fall through the air very slowly. The sunlight picked out the green facings of his uniform as he sailed over the parapet of the church roof. A long scream of pure terror rang out in the silence. Then he hit the ground with a thump that could be heard in the bell tower. and the scream was abruptly cut off. After a moment of quiet, a huge cheer went up. Grigori realized the people were cheering him. They could see the police uniform on the ground and the army uniform in the turret, and they had worked out what had happened. As he watched, they came out of doorways and around corners and stood in the street, looking up at him, shouting and applauding. He was a hero. He did not feel comfortable about that. He had killed several people in the war and was no longer squeamish about it. But all the same, he found it hard to celebrate another death, much as Kozlov had deserved to die. He stood there a few moments longer, letting them applaud but feeling uneasy. Then he ducked back inside and went down the spiral staircase. He picked up his revolver and his rifle on the way down. When he emerged into the church, Father Mikhail was waiting, looking scared. Grigori pointed the revolver at him. "I ought to shoot you," he said. "That sniper you allowed onto your roof killed two of my friends and at least three other people, and you're a murdering devil for letting him do it." The priest was so shocked to be called a devil that he was lost for words. But Grigori could not bring himself to shoot an unarmed civilian, so he grunted in disgust and went outside. The men of his platoon were waiting for him and roared their approval as he stepped into the sunshine. He could not stop them lifting him onto their shoulders and carrying him in procession. From his elevated viewpoint, he saw that the atmosphere in the street had changed. People were more drunk, and on every block there were one or two passed out in doorways. He was startled to see men and women doing a lot more than just kissing in the alleyways. Everyone had a gun. Clearly the mob had raided other arsenals, and perhaps arms factories too. At every intersection there were crashed cars, some with ambulance and doctors attending to the injured. Children as well as adults were on the streets, the small boys having a particularly good time, stealing food and smoking cigarettes and playing in abandoned automobiles. Grigori saw a fur shop being looted with an efficiency that appeared professional, and he spotted Trofim, a former associate of Lev's, carrying armfuls of coats out of the store and loading them onto a handcart, watched by another crony of Lev's, the dishonest policeman, Fyodor, now wearing a peasant-style overcoat to hide his uniform. The city's criminals saw the revolution as an opportunity. After a while, Grigori's men put him down. The afternoon light was growing dim, and several bonfires had been lit in the street. People gathered around them, drinking and singing songs. Grigori was appalled to see a boy of about 10 take a pistol from a soldier who had passed out. It was a long-barreled Luger P-08 machine pistol, a gun issued to German artillery crew. The soldier must have taken it from a prisoner at the front. The boy held it in both hands, grinning, and pointed it at the man on the ground. As Grigori moved to take the gun away, the boy pulled the trigger, and a bullet thudded into the drunk soldier's chest. The boy screamed, but in his fright he kept the trigger pulled back, so that the machine pistol continued firing. The recoil jerked the boy's arm upward, and he sprayed bullets, hitting an old woman and another soldier, until the 8-round magazine was empty. Then he dropped the gun. Before Grigori could react to this horror, he heard a shout and turned. In the doorway of a closed hat shop, a couple were having full sexual intercourse. The woman had her back to the wall, and her skirt up around her waist, her legs spread apart, and her booted feet firmly planted on the ground. The man, who wore the uniform of a corporal, stood between her legs, knees bent, trousers unbuttoned, thrusting. Grigori's platoon stood around them, cheering. The man appeared to reach his climax. He withdrew hastily, turned away and buttoned his fly, while the woman pushed her skirts down. A soldier called Igor said, "Wait a minute, my turn!" He pulled up the woman's skirts, showing her white legs. The others cheered. "No!" the woman said, and tried to push him away. She was drunk, but not helpless. Igor was a short, wiry man of unexpected strength. He pushed her up against the wall and grabbed her wrists. "Come on," he said. "One soldier's as good as another." The woman struggled, but two other soldiers grabbed her and held her still. Her original partner said, "Hey, leave her alone." "You've had your turn. Now it's mine," said Igor, unbuttoning. Grigori was revolted by this scene. "Stop it," he shouted. Igor gave him a challenging look. "Are you giving me an order as an officer, Grigori Sergeyevich?" "Not as an officer. As a human being," Grigori said. "Come on, Igor. You can see she doesn't want you. There are plenty more women." "I want this one." Igor looked around.
We all want this one, don't we, boys?
Grigori stepped forward and stood with his hands on his hips. Are you men or dogs? He cried. The woman said no. He put his arm around the angry Igor.
Tell me something, comrade,
he said. Is there anywhere around here where a man can get a drink? Igor grinned. The soldiers cheered, and the woman slipped away. Grigori said, I see a small hotel across the street. Shall we ask the proprietor whether, by any chance, he has any vodka? The men cheered again, and they all went into the hotel. In the lobby, a frightened proprietor was serving free beer. Grigori thought he was wise. It took men longer to drink beer than vodka, and they were less likely to become violent. He accepted a glass and drank a mouthful. His elation had vanished. He felt as if he had been drunk and sobered up. The incident with the woman in the doorway had appalled him, and the small boy firing the machine pistol had been horrendous. Revolution was not a simple matter of throwing off your chains. There were dangers in arming the people. Allowing soldiers to commandeer the cars of the bourgeoisie was almost as lethal. Even the apparently harmless freedom to kiss anyone who took your fancy had led, in a few hours, to Grigori's platoon attempting a gang rape. It could not go on. There had to be order. Grigori did not want to go back to the old days, of course. The Tsar had given them bread queues, brutal police, and soldiers without boots. But there had to be freedom without chaos. Grigori mumbled an excuse about needing to piss and slipped away from his men. He walked back the way he had come along Nevsky Prospect. The people had won today's battle. The Tsar's police and army officers had been defeated. But if that led only to an orgy of violence, it would not be long before people clamored for a return of the old regime. Who was in charge? The Duma had defied the Tsar and refused to close, according to what Kerensky had told Grigori yesterday. The parliament was more or less impotent, but at least it symbolized democracy. Grigori decided to go to the Taurida Palace and see if anything was happening there. He walked north to the river, then east to the Taurida Gardens. Night had fallen by the time he got there. The classical facade of the palace had dozens of windows, and they were all lit up. Several thousand people had had the same idea as Grigori, and the broad front courtyard was crammed with soldiers and workers milling around. A man with a megaphone was making an announcement, repeating it over and over again. Grigori worked his way to the front so that he could hear. The workers' group of the War Industry Committee has been released from the Kresty prison, the man shouted. Grigori was not sure who they were, but their name sounded good. Together with other comrades, they have formed the Provisional Executive Committee of the Soviet of Workers' Deputies. Grigori liked that idea. A Soviet was a council of representatives. There had been a St. Petersburg Soviet in 1905. Grigori had been only 16 at the time, but he knew the Soviet had been elected by factory workers and had organized strikes. It had had a charismatic leader, Leon Trotsky, since exiled. All of this will be officially announced in a special edition of the newspaper Izvestia. The executive committee has formed a food supply commission to ensure that workers and soldiers are fed. It has also created a military commission to defend the revolution. There was no mention of the Duma. The crowd was cheering, but Grigori wondered whether soldiers would take orders from a self-elected military commission. Where was the democracy in all this? His question was answered by the final sentence of the announcement. The committee appeals to workers and soldiers to elect representatives to the Soviet as quickly as possible, and to send their representatives here to the palace to take part in the new revolutionary government. That was what Grigori had wanted to hear. The new revolutionary government, a Soviet of workers and soldiers. Now there would be change without disorder. Full of enthusiasm, he left the courtyard and headed back toward the barracks. Sooner or later, the men would come back to their beds. He could hardly wait to tell them the news. Then, for the first time, they would have an election. 4. On the morning of the next day, the 1st Machine Gun Regiment gathered on the parade ground to elect a representative to the Petrograd Soviet. Izak proposed Sergeant Grigori Peshkov. He was elected unopposed. Grigori was pleased. He knew what life was like for soldiers and workers, and he would bring the machine oil smell of real life to the corridors of power. He would never forget his roots and put on a top hat. He would make sure that unrest led to improvements, not to random violence. Now he had a real chance to make a better life for Katerina and Vladimir. He walked quickly across the Leteni Bridge, alone this time, and headed for the Taurida Palace. His urgent priority had to be bread. Katerina, Vladimir, and the other 2.5 million inhabitants of Petrograd had to eat, and now, as he assumed responsibility, at least in his imagination, he began to feel daunted. The farmers and the millers in the countryside had to send more flour to the Petrograd bakers immediately, but they would not do so unless they were paid. How was the Soviet going to make sure there was enough money? He began to wonder whether overthrowing the government might have been the easy part. The palace had a long central facade and two wings. Grigori discovered that both the Duma and the Soviet were in session. Appropriately, the Duma, the old middle-class parliament, was in the right wing, and the Soviet in the left. But who was in charge? No one knew. That would have to be resolved first, Grigori thought impatiently, before they could start on the real problems. On the steps of the palace, Grigori spotted the broomstick figure and bushy black hair of Constantine. He realized with a shock that he had not made any attempt to tell Constantine of the death of Varya, his mother. But he saw immediately that Constantine knew. As well as his red armband, Constantine was wearing a black scarf tied around his hat. Grigori embraced him. "I saw it happen," he said. "Was it you who killed the police sniper?" "Yes. Thank you. But her real revenge will be the revolution." Constantine had been elected as one of two deputies from the Putilov works. During the afternoon, more and more deputies arrived, until, by early evening, there were 3,000 of them crammed into the huge Catherine Hall. Nearly all were soldiers. Troops were already organized into regiments and platoons, and Grigori guessed it had been easier for them to arrange elections than for the factory workers, many of whom were locked out of their workplaces. Some deputies had been elected by a few dozen people, others by thousands. Democracy was not as simple as it seemed. Someone proposed that they should rename themselves the Petrograd Soviet of Workers and Soldiers Deputies, and the idea was approved by thunderous applause. There seemed to be no procedure. There was no agenda, no proposing or seconding of resolutions, no voting mechanism. People just stood up and spoke, often more than one at a time. On the platform, several suspiciously middle-class-looking men were scribbling notes, and Grigori guessed these were the members of the executive committee formed yesterday. At least someone was taking minutes. Despite the worrying chaos, there was tremendous excitement. They all felt they had fought a battle and won. For better or worse, they were making a new world. But no one was talking about bread. Frustrated by the inaction of the Soviet, Grigori and Constantine left the Catherine Hall during a particularly chaotic moment and walked across the palace to find out what the Duma was up to. On the way, they saw troops with red armbands stockpiling food and ammunition in the hallway, as if for a siege. Of course, Grigori thought, the Tsar is not simply going to accept what has happened. At some point he will try to regain control by force, and that would mean attacking this building. In the right wing, they came across Count Makalakov, a director of the Putilov works. He was a delegate for a right-of-center party, but he spoke to them politely enough. He told them that yet another committee had been formed, the Temporary Committee of Duma members for the restoration of order in the capital and the establishment of relations with individuals and institutions. Despite its ludicrous title, Grigori felt it was an ominous attempt by the Duma to take control. He became more worried when Makalakov told him the committee had appointed a Colonel Engelhardt as commander of Petrograd. "Yes," said Makalakov with satisfaction, "and they have instructed all soldiers to return to barracks and obey orders." "What?" Grigori was shocked. "But that would destroy the revolution. The Tsar's officers would regain control." "The members of the Duma do not believe there is a revolution. The members of the Duma are idiots," Grigori said angrily. Makalakov put his nose in the air and walked away. Constantine shared Grigori's anger. "This is a counter-revolution," he said, "and it must be stopped," said Grigori. They hurried back to the left wing. In the big hall, a chairman was attempting to control a debate. Grigori leaped onto the platform. "I have an emergency announcement," he shouted. "Everyone has," said the chairman wearily. "But what the hell? Go ahead. The Duma is ordering soldiers to return to barracks and to accept the authority of their officers." A shout of protest went up from the delegates. Comrades! Grigori shouted, trying to quiet them. We are not going back to the old ways. They roared their agreement. The people of the city must have bread. Our women must feel safe on the streets. The factories must reopen and the mills must roll. But not in the same old way. They were listening to him now, unsure where he was going. We soldiers must stop beating up the bourgeoisie, stop harassing women on the street, and stop looting wine shops. We must return to our barracks, sober up, and resume our duties. But, he paused dramatically, under our own conditions. There was a rumble of assent. What should those conditions be? Someone shouted, elected committees to issue orders instead of officers. Another said, Namar, Your Excellency and Most High Radiance, they should be called Colonel and General. Now saluting, cried another. Grigori did not know what to do. Everyone had his own suggestion. He could not hear them all, let alone remember them. The chairman came to his rescue. I propose that all those with suggestions should form a group with Comrade Sokolov. Grigori knew that Nikolai Sokolov was a left-wing lawyer. That's good, he thought. We need someone to draft our proposal in correct legal terms. The chairman went on, when you have agreed what you want, bring your proposal to the Soviet for approval. Right. Grigori jumped off the platform. Sokolov was sitting at a small table to one side of the hall. Grigori and Konstantin approached him, along with a dozen or more deputies.
Very well, said Sokolov. Who is this addressed to?
Grigori was baffled again. He was about to say, to the world. But a soldier said, to the Petrograd garrison. Another said,
and all the soldiers of the guard, the army and artillery.
And the fleet, said someone else.
Very good, said Sokolov, writing.
For immediate and precise execution, I presume?
Yes.
And to the workers of Petrograd for information?
Grigori became impatient.
Yes, yes, he said. Now, who proposed elected committees?
That was me, said a soldier with a grey moustache.
He sat on the edge of the table directly in front of Sokolov. As if giving dictation, he said, all troops should set up committees of their elected representatives. Sokolov, still writing, said, in all companies, battalions, regiments. Someone shouted, depots, batteries, squadrons, warships. The grey moustache said, those who have not yet elected deputies must do so.
Right, said Grigori impatiently. Now, weapons of all kinds, including armored cars, are under the control of the battalion and company committees, not the officers.
Several of the soldiers voiced their agreement.
Very good, said Sokolov.
Grigori went on. A military unit is subordinate to the Soviet of workers' and soldiers' deputies and its committees. For the first time, Sokolov looked up.
That would mean the Soviet controls the army.
Yes, said Grigori.
The orders of the military commission of the Duma are to be followed only when they do not contradict the decisions of the Soviet.
Sokolov continued to look at Grigori.
This makes the Duma as powerless as it always was. Before it was subject to the whim of the Tsar. Now every decision will require the approval of the Soviet.
Exactly, said Grigori.
So the Soviet is supreme.
Write it down, said Grigori.
Sokolov wrote it down. Someone said, officers are forbidden to be rude to other ranks.
All right, said Sokolov.
And must not address them as tea, as if we were animals or children.
Grigori thought these clauses were trivial.
The document needs a title, he said.
Sokolov said, what do you suggest?
Have you headed previous orders by the Soviet?
There are no previous orders, said Sokolov. This is the first.
That's it then, said Grigori.
Call it Order Number 1.
5. It gave Grigori profound satisfaction to have passed his first piece of legislation as an elected representative. Over the next 2 days there were several more, and he became deeply absorbed in the minute-by-minute work of a revolutionary government. But he thought all the time about Katerina and Vladimir, and on Thursday evening he at last got a chance to slip away and check on them. His heart was full of foreboding as he walked to the southwest suburbs. Katerina had promised to stay away from trouble, but the women of Petrograd believed this was their revolution as much as the men's. After all, it had started on International Women's Day. This was nothing new. Grigori's mother had died in the failed revolution of 1905. If Katerina had decided to go into the city center with Vladimir on her hip to see what was going on, she would not have been the only mother to do so. And many innocent people had died, shot by the police, trampled in crowds, run over by drunk soldiers in commandeered cars, or hit by stray bullets. As he entered the old house, he dreaded being met by one of the tenants with a solemn face and tears in her eyes, saying, "Something terrible has happened." He went up the stairs, tapped on the door, and walked in. Katerina leaped from her chair and threw herself into his arms. "You're alive," she said. She kissed him eagerly. "I've been so worried. I don't know what we would do without you." "I'm sorry I couldn't come sooner," Grigori said, "but I'm a delegate to the Soviet." "A delegate?" Katerina beamed with pride. "My husband." She hugged him. Grigori had actually impressed her. He had never done that before. "A delegate is only a representative of the people who elected him," he said modestly. "But they always choose the cleverest and the most reliable." "Well, they try to." The room was dimly lit by an oil lamp. Grigori put a parcel on the table. With his new status, he had no trouble getting food from the barracks kitchen. "There are some matches and a blanket in there too," he said.
"Thank you.
I hope you've been staying indoors as much as you can. It's still dangerous on the streets. Some of us are making a revolution, but others are just going wild. I've hardly been out. I've been waiting to hear from you. How's our little boy?" Vladimir was asleep in the corner. "He misses his daddy." She meant Grigori. It was not Grigori's wish that Vladimir should call him daddy, but he had accepted Katerina's fancy. It was not likely that any of them would ever see Lev again. There had been no word from him for almost 3 years, so the child would never know the truth, and perhaps that was better. Katerina said, "I'm sorry he's asleep. He loves to see you. I'll talk to him in the morning."
"You can stay the night? How wonderful!"
Grigori sat down, and Katerina knelt in front of him and pulled off his boots.
"You look tired," she said.
"I am.
Let's go to bed. It's late."
She began to unbutton his tunic, and he sat back and let her. "General Kabalov is hiding out in the Admiralty," he said. "We were afraid he might recapture the railway stations, but he didn't even try."
"Why not?"
Grigori shrugged. "Cowardice. The Tsar ordered Ivanov to march on Petrograd and set up a military dictatorship, but Ivanov's men became mutinous and the expedition was cancelled." Katerina frowned.
"Has the old ruling class just given up?"
"It seems that way. Strange, isn't it? But clearly there isn't going to be a counter-revolution." They got into bed, Grigori in his underwear, Katerina with her dress still on. She had never stripped naked in front of him. Perhaps she felt she had to hold something back. It was a peculiarity of hers that he accepted, not without regret. He took her in his arms and kissed her. When he entered her, she said,
"I love you,"
and he felt he was the luckiest man in the world. Afterwards, she said sleepily,
"What will happen next?"
"There's going to be a constituent assembly, elected by what they called the four-tail suffrage, universal, direct, secret, and equal. Meanwhile, the Duma is forming a provisional government.
Who will be its leader?"
"Lvov." Katerina sat upright.
"A prince? Why?"
"They want the confidence of all classes."
"To hell with all classes!"
Indignation made her even more beautiful, bringing color to her face and a sparkle to her eyes.
"The workers and soldiers have made the revolution. Why do we need the confidence of anyone else?"
This question had bothered Grigori too, but the answer had convinced him.
"We need businessmen to reopen factories, wholesalers to recommend supplying the city, shopkeepers to open their doors again.
And what about the Tsar?" "The Duma is demanding his abdication. They have sent 2 delegates to Pskov to tell him so." Katerina was wide-eyed.
"Abdication? The Tsar? But that would be the end."
"Yes."
"Is it possible?"
"I don't know," said Grigori. "We'll find out tomorrow." 6. In the Catherine Hall of the Taurida Palace on Friday, the debate was desultory. 2,000 or 3,000 men and a few women packed the room, and the air was full of tobacco smoke and the smell of unwashed soldiers. They were waiting to hear what the Tsar would do. The debate was frequently interrupted for announcements. Often they were less than urgent, A soldier would stand up to say that his battalion had formed a committee and arrested the colonel. Sometimes they were not even announcements, but speeches calling for the defense of the revolution. But Grigori knew something was different when a gray-haired sergeant jumped onto the platform, pink-faced and breathless, with a sheet of paper in his hand and called for silence. Slowly and loudly he said, "The Tsar has signed a document." The cheering began after those few words. The sergeant raised his voice, "Abdicating the crown." The cheer rose to a roar. Grigori was electrified. Had it really happened? Had the dream come true? The sergeant held up his hand for quiet. He had not yet finished. "And because of the poor health of his 12-year-old son, Alexei, he has named as his successor the Grand Duke Mikhail, the Tsar's younger brother." The cheers turned to howls of protest. "Now!" Grigori shouted, and his voice was lost among thousands. When after several minutes they began to quieten, a greater roar was heard from outside. The crowd in the courtyard must have heard the same news, and were receiving it with the same indignation. Grigori said to Constantine, "The provisional government must not accept this." "Agreed," said Constantine. "Let's go and tell them so." They left the Soviet and crossed the palace. The ministers of the newly formed government were meeting in a room where the old temporary committee had met. Indeed, they were, to a worrying degree, the same men. They were already discussing the Tsar's statement. Pavel Milyukov was on his feet. The monocled moderate was arguing that the monarchy had to be preserved as a symbol of legitimacy. "Horseshit," Grigori muttered. The monarchy symbolized incompetence, cruelty, and defeat, but not legitimacy. Fortunately, others felt the same way. Kerensky, who was now Minister of Justice, proposed that Grand Duke Mikhail should be told to refuse the crown, and to Grigori's relief, the majority agreed. Kerensky and Prince Lvov were mandated to go see Mikhail immediately. Milyukov glared through his monocle and said, "And I should go with them, to represent the minority view." Grigori assumed this foolish suggestion would be trodden upon, but the other ministers weakly assented. At that point, Grigori stood up. Without forethought, he said, "And I shall accompany the ministers as an observer from the Petrograd Soviet." "Very well, very well," said Kerensky wearily. They left the palace by a side door and got into two waiting Renault limousines. The former president of the Duma, the hugely fat Mikhail Rodzianko, also came. Grigori could not quite believe this was happening to him. He was part of a delegation going to order a crown prince to refuse to become Tsar. Less than a week ago, he had meekly got down from a table because Lieutenant Krylov had ordered him to. The world was changing so fast, it was hard to keep up. Grigori had never been inside the home of a wealthy aristocrat, and it was like entering a dream world. The large house was stuffed with possessions. Everywhere he looked, there were gorgeous vases, elaborate clocks, silver candelabra, and jeweled ornaments. If he had grabbed a golden bowl and run out of the front door, he could have sold it for enough money to buy himself a house, except that right now no one was buying golden bowls. They just wanted bread. Prince Georgi Lvov, a silver-haired man with a huge bushy beard, clearly was not impressed by the decor, nor intimidated by the solemnity of his errand, but everyone else seemed nervous. They waited in the drawing room, frowned upon by ancestral portraits, shuffling their feet on the thick rugs. At last Grand Duke Mikhail appeared. He was a prematurely balding man of 38 with a little mustache. To Grigori's surprise, he appeared to be more nervous than the delegation. He seemed shy and bewildered, despite a haughty tilt to his head. He eventually summoned enough courage to say, "What do you have to tell me?" Lvov replied, "We have come to ask you not to accept the crown." "Oh dear," said Mikhail, and seemed not to know what to do next. Kerensky retained his presence of mind. He spoke clearly and firmly. "The people of Petrograd have reacted with outrage to the decision of His Majesty the Tsar," he said. "Already a huge contingent of soldiers is marching on the Taurida Palace. There will be a violent uprising, followed by a civil war, unless we announce immediately that you have refused to take over as Tsar." "Oh my goodness," said Mikhail mildly. The Grand Duke was not very bright, Grigori realized. "Why am I surprised?" he thought. "If these people were intelligent, they would not be on the point of losing the throne of Russia." The monocled Milyukov said, "Your Royal Highness,
I represent the minority view in the provisional government. In our opinion, the monarchy is the only symbol of authority accepted by the people. Mikhail looked even more bewildered. The last thing he needed was a choice, Grigori thought. That only made matters worse. The Grand Duke said, "Would you mind if I had a word alone with Rodzianko? No, don't all leave. We will just retire to a side room." When the dithering Tsar designate and the fat president had left, the others talked in low voices. No one spoke to Grigori. He was the only working-class man in the room, and he sensed they were a bit frightened of him, suspecting, rightly, that the pockets of his sergeant's uniform were stuffed with guns and ammunition. Rodzianko reappeared. "He asked me whether we would guarantee his personal safety if he became Tsar," he said. Grigori was disgusted but not surprised that the Grand Duke was concerned about himself rather than his country. "I told him we could not," Rodzianko finished. Kerensky said, "And?" "He will rejoin us in a moment." There was a pause that seemed endless. Then Mikhail came back. They all fell silent. For a long moment, no one said anything. At last, Mikhail said, "I have decided to decline the crown." Grigori's heart seemed to stop. 8 days, he thought. 8 days ago, the women of Vyborg marched across the Leteni Bridge. Today, the rule of the Romanovs has ended. He recalled the words of his mother on the day she died. "I will not rest until Russia is a republic. Rest now, mother," he thought. Kerensky was shaking the Grand Duke's hand and saying something pompous, but Grigori was not listening. "We have done it," he thought. "We made a revolution. We have deposed the Tsar." 7. In Berlin, Otto von Ulrich opened a magnum of the 1892 Perrier-Jouët Champagne. The von Ulrichs had invited the von der Helberts to lunch. Monica's father, Conrad, was a Graf, or Count, and her mother was therefore a Grafin, or Countess. Grafin Eva von der Helbart was a formidable woman with grey hair, piled in an elaborate coiffure. Before lunch, she cornered Walter and told him that Monica was an accomplished violin player and had been top of her school class in all subjects. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw his father talking to Monica and guessed she was getting a school report about him. He was irritated with his parents for persisting in foisting Monica on him. The fact that he found himself strongly attracted to her made matters worse. She was intelligent as well as beautiful. Her hair was always carefully dressed, but he could not help imagining her unpinning it at night and shaking her head to liberate her curls. Sometimes, these days, he found it hard to picture Maud. Now Otto raised his glass. "Goodbye to the Tsar," he said. "I'm surprised at you, father," said Walter irritably. "Are you really celebrating the overthrow of a legitimate monarch by a mob of factory workers and mutinous soldiers?" Otto went red in the face. Walter's sister Greta patted her father's arm soothingly. "Take no notice, Daddy," she said. "Walter just says these things to annoy you." Conrad said, "I got to know Tsar Nicholas when I was at our embassy in Petrograd." Walter said, "And what did you think of him, sir?" Monica answered for her father. Giving Walter a conspiratorial grin, she said, "Daddy used to say that if the Tsar had been born to a different station in life, he might, with an effort, have become a competent postman." "This is the tragedy of inherited monarchy." Walter turned to his father. "But you must surely disapprove of democracy in Russia."
"Democracy," said Otto derisively. "We shall see. All we know is that the new Prime Minister is a liberal aristocrat."
Monica said to Walter, "Do you think Prince Lvov will try to make peace with us?" It was the question of the hour.
"I hope so," said Walter, trying not to look at Monica's breasts. "If all our troops on the Eastern Front could be switched to France, we could overrun the Allies."
She raised her glass and looked over its rim into Walter's eyes.
"Then let's drink to that," she said.
In a cold, wet trench in northeastern France, Billy's platoon was drinking gin. The bottle had been produced by Robin Mortimer, the cashiered officer.
"I've been saving this," he said.
"Well, knock me down with a feather," said Billy, using one of Mildred's expressions.
Mortimer was a surly beggar and had never been known to buy anyone a drink. Mortimer splashed liquor into their mess tins.
"Here's to bloody revolution," he said, and they all drank, then held out their tins for refills.
Billy had been in high spirits, even before drinking the gin. The Russians had proved it was still possible to overthrow tyrants. They were singing the red flag when Earl Fitzherbert came limping around the traverse, splashing through the mud. He was a colonel now, and more arrogant than ever. "Be quiet, you men!" he shouted. The singing died down gradually. Billy said, "We're celebrating the overthrow of the Tsar of Russia." Fitz said angrily, "He was a legitimate monarch, and those who deposed him are criminals. No more singing." Billy's contempt for Fitz went up a notch. "He was a tyrant who murdered thousands of his subjects, and all civilized men are rejoicing today." Fitz looked more closely at him. The Earl no longer wore an eye patch, but his left eyelid had a permanent droop. However, it did not seem to affect his eyesight. "Sergeant Williams, I might have guessed. I know you, and your family." "And how," Billy thought. "Your sister's a peace agitator." "So's yours, sir," said Billy, and Robin Mortimer laughed raucously, then shut up suddenly. Fitz said to Billy, "One more insolent word out of you, and you'll be on a charge." "Sorry, sir," said Billy. "Now calm down, all of you, and no more singing." Fitz walked away. Billy said quietly, "Long live the revolution." Fitz pretended not to hear. In London, Princess Bea screamed, "No!" "Try to stay calm," said Maud, who had just told her the news. "They cannot!" Bea screamed. "They cannot make our beloved Tsar abdicate! He is the father of his people!" "It may be for the best. I don't believe you. It's a wicked lie." The door opened and Grout put his head in, looking worried. Bea picked up a Japanese bottle vase containing an arrangement of dried grasses and hurled it across the room. It hit the wall and smashed. Maud patted Bea's shoulder. "There, there," she said. She was not sure what else to do. She herself was delighted that the Tsar had been overthrown, but all the same she sympathized with Bea, for whom an entire way of life had been destroyed. Grout crooked a finger and a maid came in, looking frightened. He pointed at the broken vase and the maid began to pick up the pieces. The tea things were on a table. Cups, saucers, teapots, jugs of milk and cream, bowls of sugar. Bea swept them all violently to the floor. "Those revolutionaries are going to kill everyone!" The butler knelt down and began to clear up the mess.
"Don't excite yourself," Maud said.
Bea began to cry.
"The poor Tsaritsa and her children. What will become of them?"
"Perhaps you should lie down for a while," Maud said. "Come on, I'll walk you to your room."
She took Bea's elbow and Bea allowed herself to be led away.
"It's the end of everything,"
Bea sobbed.
"Never mind," said Maud. "Perhaps it's a new beginning."
Ethel and Bernie were in Aberowen. It was a sort of honeymoon. Ethel was enjoying showing Bernie the places of her childhood, the pithead, the chapel, the school. She even showed him around Tŷ Gwen. Fitz and Bea were not in residence, though she did not take him to the gardenia's suite. They were staying with the Griffiths family, who had again offered Ethel Tommy's room, which saved disturbing Grandpa. They were in Mrs. Griffiths's kitchen when her husband, Len, atheist and revolutionary socialist, burst in, waving a newspaper.
"The Tsar have abdicated," he said.
They all cheered and clapped. For a week they had been hearing of riots in Petrograd, and Ethel had been wondering how it would end. Bernie asked,
"Who's took over?"
"Provisional government under Prince Lvov," said Len.
"Not quite a triumph for socialism, then?" said Bernie.
"No." Ethel said, "Cheer up, you men, one thing at a time. Let's go to the Two Crowns and celebrate. I'll leave Lloyd with Mrs. Ponty for a while."
The women put on their hats, and they all went to the pub. Within an hour the place was crammed. Ethel was astonished to see her mother and father come in. Mrs. Griffiths saw them too and said, "What the hell are they doing here?" A few minutes later, Ethel's da stood on a chair and called for quiet.
"I know some of you are surprised to see me here, but special occasions call for special actions."
He showed them a pint glass. "I haven't changed my habits of a lifetime, but the landlord has been kind enough to give me a glass of tap water." They all laughed.
"I'm here to share with my neighbours the triumph that have took place in Russia."
He held up his glass.
"A toast to the revolution."
They all cheered and drank.
"Well," said Ethel,
"da in the Two Crowns. I never thought I'd see the day."
In Joseph Vyalov's ultramodern prairie house in Buffalo, Lev Peshkov helped himself to a drink from the cocktail cabinet. He no longer drank vodka. Living with his wealthy father-in-law, he had developed a taste for Scotch whisky. He liked it the way Americans drank it, with lumps of ice. Lev did not like living with his in-laws. He would have preferred for him and Olga to have a place of their own. But Olga preferred it this way, and her father paid for everything. Until Lev could build up a stash of his own, he was stuck. Joseph was reading the paper, and Lena was sewing. Lev raised his glass to them. "Long live the revolution!" he said exuberantly.
"What's your words?" said Joseph. "It's going to be bad for business."
Olga came in. "Pour me a little glass of sherry, please, darling," she said. Lev suppressed a sigh. She loved to ask him to perform little services, and in front of her parents he could not refuse. He poured sweet sherry into a small glass and handed it to her, bowing like a waiter. She smiled prettily, missing the irony. He drank a mouthful of scotch and savored the taste and the burn of it. Mrs. Vyalov said, "I feel sorry for the poor Tsaritsa and her children. What will they do?" Joseph said, "They'll all be killed by the mob, I shouldn't wonder." "Poor things. What did the Tsar ever do to those revolutionaries to deserve this?"
"I can answer that question," Lev said.
He knew he should shut up, but he could not, especially with whiskey warming his guts.
"When I was 11 years old, the factory where my mother worked went on strike."
Mrs. Vyalov tutted. She did not believe in strikes. "The police rounded up all the children of the strikers.
I'll never forget it. I was terrified."
"Why would they do a thing like that?" said Mrs. Vyalov.
"The police flogged us all," Lev said, "on our bottoms with canes, to teach our parents a lesson."
Mrs. Vyalov had gone white. She could not bear cruelty to children or animals.
"That's what the Tsar and his regime did to me, mother," said Lev.
He clinked ice in his glass.
"That's why I toast the revolution."
"What do you think, Gus?" said President Wilson. "You're the only person around here who's actually been to Petrograd. What's going to happen?"
"I hate to sound like a State Department official, but it could go either way," said Gus.
The president laughed. They were in the Oval Office. Wilson behind the desk, Gus standing in front of it.
"Come on," Wilson said. "Take a guess. Will the Russians pull out of the war or not? It's the most important question of the year."
"Okay. All the ministers in the new government belong to scary-sounding political parties with socialist and revolutionary in their names. But in fact, they're middle-class businessmen and professionals. What they really want is a bourgeois revolution that gives them freedom to promote industry and commerce. But the people want bread, peace, and land. Bread for the factory workers, peace for the soldiers, and land for the peasants. None of that really appeals to men like Lvov and Kerensky. So, to answer your question, I think Lvov's government will try for gradual change. In particular, they will carry on fighting the war. But the workers will not be satisfied."
"And who will win in the end?"
Gus recalled his trip to St. Petersburg, and the man who had demonstrated the casting of a locomotive wheel in a dirty, tumble-down foundry at the Putilov factory. Later, Gus had seen the same man in a fight with a cop over some girl. He could not remember the man's name, but he could picture him now, his big shoulders and strong arms, one finger a stump, but most of all his fierce, blue-eyed look of unstoppable determination.
"The Russian people," Gus said, "they will win in the end."
Chapter 24. April 1917. On a mild day in early spring, Walter walked with Monika von der Helbart in the garden of her parents' townhouse in Berlin. It was a grand house, and the garden was large, with a tennis pavilion, a bowling green, a riding school for exercising the horses, and a children's playground with swings and a slide. Walter remembered coming here as a child and thinking it was paradise. However, it was no longer an idyllic playground. All but the oldest horses had gone to the army. Chickens scratched on the flagstones of the broad terrace. Monica's mother was fattening a pig in the tennis pavilion. Goats grazed the bowling green, and it was rumored that the Grafin milked them herself. However, the old trees were coming into leaf. The sun was shining, and Walter was in his waistcoat and shirt sleeves, with his coat slung over his shoulder, a state of undress that would have displeased his mother. But she was in the house, gossiping with the Grafin. Her sister Greta had been walking with Walter and Monica, but she had made an excuse and left them alone, another thing Mother would have deplored, at least in theory. Monica had a dog called Pierre. It was a standard poodle, long-legged and graceful, with a lot of curly, rust-coloured hair and light brown eyes, and Walter could not help thinking that it looked a little like Monica, beautiful though she was. He liked the way she acted with her dog. She did not pet it or feed it scraps or talk to it in a baby voice, as some girls did. She just let it walk at her heel, and occasionally threw an old tennis ball for it to fetch. "It's so disappointing about the rations," she said. Walter nodded. Prince Lvov's government had announced they would continue to fight. Germany's Eastern Front was not to be relieved, and there would be no reinforcements for France. The war would drag on. "Our only hope now is that Lvov's government will fall and the peace faction will take over," Walter said. "Is that likely?" "It's hard to say. The left revolutionaries are still demanding bread, peace, and land. The government has promised a democratic election for a constituent assembly, but who will win?" He picked up a twig and threw it for Pierre. The dog bounded after it and proudly brought it back. Walter bent down to pat its head, and when he straightened up, Monica was very close to him. "I like you, Walter," she said, looking very directly at him with her amber eyes. "I feel as if we would never run out of things to talk about." He had the same feeling, and he knew that if he tried to kiss her now, she would let him. He stepped away. "I like you too," he said, "and I like your dog." He laughed, to show that he was speaking light-heartedly. All the same, he could see that she was hurt. She bit her lip and turned away. She had been about as bold as was possible for a well-brought-up girl, and he had rejected her. They walked on. After a long silence, Monica said, "What is your secret, I wonder?" "My God," he thought, "she's sharp." "I have no secrets," he lied. "Do you?" "None worth telling." She reached up and brushed something off his shoulder. "A bee," she said. "It's too soon in the year for bees. Perhaps we shall have an early summer. It's not that warm." She pretended to shiver. "You're right. It's chilly. Would you fetch me a wrap? If you go to the kitchen and ask a maid, she will find one." "Of course." It was not chilly, but a gentleman never refused such a request, no matter how whimsical. She obviously wanted a minute alone. He strolled back to the house. He had to spurn her advances, but he was sorry to hurt her. They were well suited. Their mothers were quite right, and clearly Monica could not understand why he kept pushing her away. He entered the house and went down the back stairs to the basement, where he found an elderly housemaid in a black dress and a lace cap. She went off to find a shawl. Walter waited in the hall. The house was decorated in the up-to-date Jungenstil, which did away with the Rococo flourishes loved by Walter's parents and favoured well-lit rooms with gentle colours. The pillared hall was all cool grey marble and mushroom-coloured carpet. It seemed to him as if Maud was a million miles away on another planet. And in a way she was, for the pre-war world would never come back. He had not seen his wife nor heard from her for almost 3 years, and he might never meet her again. Although she had not faded from his mind, he would never forget the passion they had shared. He did find to his distress that he could no longer recall the fine details of their times together, what she was wearing, where they were when they kissed or held hands, or what they ate and drank and talked about when they met at those endlessly similar London parties. Sometimes it crossed his mind that the war had, in a way, divorced them, but he pushed the thought aside. It was shamefully disloyal. The maid brought him a yellow cashmere shawl. He returned to Monica, who was sitting on a tree stump with Pierre at her feet. Walter gave her the shawl and she put it around her shoulders. The colour suited her, making her eyes gleam and her skin glow. She had a strange look on her face, and she handed him his wallet. "This must have fallen out of your coat," she said. "Oh, thank you." He returned it to the inside pocket of the coat that he still had slung over his shoulder. She said, "Let's go back to the house." "As you wish." Her mood had changed. Perhaps she had simply decided to give up on him, or had something else happened. He was struck by a frightening thought. Had his wallet really fallen out of his coat, or had she taken it like a pickpocket when she brushed that unlikely bee off his shoulder? "Monica," he said,
and he stopped and turned to face her. "Did you look inside my wallet?"
"You said you had no secrets," she said, and she blushed bright red. She must have seen the newspaper clipping he carried. Lady Maud Fitzherbert is always dressed in the latest fashion.
"That was most ill-mannered of you," he said angrily. He was mainly angry with himself. He should not have kept the incriminating photo. If Monica could figure out its significance, so could others. Then he would be disgraced and drummed out of the army. He might be accused of treason and jailed or even shot. He had been foolish, but he knew he would never throw the picture away. It was all he had of Maud. Monica put a hand on his arm. "I have never done anything like that in my whole life, and I'm ashamed. But you must see that I was desperate. Oh, Walter, I could fall in love with you so easily. And I can tell that you could love me, too. I can see it in your eyes and the way you smile when you see me. But you said nothing." There were tears in her eyes. "It was driving me out of my mind. I'm sorry for that." He could no longer feel indignant. She had now gone beyond the bounds of propriety and opened her heart to him. He felt terribly sad for her, sad for both of them.
"I just had to understand why you kept turning away from me. Now I do, of course. She's beautiful. She even looks a bit like me."
She wiped her tears. "She found you before I did, that's all." She stared at him with those penetrating amber eyes. "I suppose you're engaged." He could not lie to someone who was being so honest with him. He did not know what to say. She guessed the reason for his hesitation.
"Oh my goodness," she said. "You're married, aren't you?"
This was disastrous.
"If people found out, I would be in serious trouble."
"I know.
I hope I may trust you to keep my secret." "How can you ask?" she said. "You're the best man I've ever met. I wouldn't do anything to harm you. I will never breathe a word."
"Thank you. I know you'll keep your promise." She looked away, fighting back the tears.
"Let's go inside."
In the hall, she said,
"You go ahead. I must wash my face."
"All right. I hope..." Her voice broke into a sob. "I hope she knows how lucky she is," she whispered. Then she turned away and slipped into a side room. Walter put on his coat and composed himself, then went up the marble staircase. The drawing room was done in the same understated style, with blonde wood and pale blue-green curtains. Monica's parents had better taste than his, he decided. His mother looked at him and knew instantly something was wrong.
"Where is Monica?" she said sharply.
He raised an eyebrow at her. It was not like her to ask a question to which the answer might be, "gone to the toilet." She was obviously tense. He said quietly,
"She will join us in a few minutes."
"Look at this," said his father, waving a sheet of paper. "Zimmerman's office just sent it to me for my comments. Those Russian revolutionaries want to cross Germany. The nerve!"
He had had a couple of glasses of schnapps and was in an exuberant mood. Walter said politely,
"Which revolutionaries would those be, father?"
He did not really care, but was grateful for a topic of conversation.
"The ones in Zurich, Martov and Lenin and that crowd. There's supposed to be freedom of speech in Russia now that the Tsar has been deposed. So they want to go home, but they can't get there."
Monica's father, Conrad von der Helbart, said thoughtfully, "I suppose they can't. There's no way to get from Switzerland to Russia without passing through Germany. Any other overland route would involve crossing battle lines. But there are still steamers going from England across the North Sea to Sweden, aren't there?" Walter said,
"Yes, but they won't risk going via Britain.
The British detained Trotsky and Bukharin, and France or Italy would be worse."
"So they're stuck," said Otto triumphantly.
Walter said, "What will you advise Foreign Minister Zimmermann to do, father?"
"Refuse, of course. We don't want that filth contaminating our folk. Who knows what kind of trouble those devils would stir up in Germany?"
"Lenin and Martov," Walter said musingly. "Martov is a Menshevik, but Lenin is a Bolshevik."
German intelligence took a lively interest in Russian revolutionaries.
Otto said, "Bolsheviks, Mensheviks, socialists, revolutionaries, they're all the same."
"No, they're not," said Walter. "The Bolsheviks are the toughest."
Monica's mother said with spirit,
"All the more reason to keep them out of our country."
Walter ignored that.
"More importantly, the Bolsheviks abroad tend to be more radical than those at home.
The Petrograd Bolsheviks support the provisional government of Prince Lvov, but their comrades in Zurich do not. His sister Greta said, "How do you know a thing like that?" Walter knew because he had read intelligence reports from German spies in Switzerland, who were intercepting the revolutionaries' mail. But he said, "Lenin made a speech in Zurich a few days ago in which he repudiated the provisional government." Otto made a dismissive noise, but Conrad von der Helbart leaned forward in his chair. "What are you thinking, young men?" Walter said, "By refusing the revolutionaries' permission to pass through Germany, we are protecting Russia from their subversive ideas." Mother looked bewildered. "Explain, please." "I'm suggesting we should help these dangerous men get home. Once there, either they will try to undermine the Russian government and cripple its ability to make war, or alternatively, they will take power and make peace. Either way, Germany gains." There was a moment of silence while they all thought about that. Then Otto laughed loudly and clapped his hands. "My own son," he said, "there is a bit of the old man in him after all."
Two. "My dearest darling, Zurich is a cold city by a lake," Walter wrote. "But the sun shines on the water, on the leafy hillsides all around, and on the Alps in the distance. The streets are laid out in a grid with no bends. The Swiss are even more orderly than the Germans. I wish you were here, my beloved friend, as I wish you were with me wherever I am." The exclamation marks were intended to give the postal censor the impression that the writer was an excitable girl. Although Walter was in neutral Switzerland, he was still being careful that the text of the letter did not identify either the sender or the recipient. "I wonder whether you suffer the embarrassment of unwanted attention from eligible bachelors. You are so beautiful and charming that you must. I have the same problem. I don't have beauty or charm, of course, but despite that I receive advances. My mother has chosen someone for me to marry, a chum of my sister's, a person I have always known and liked. It was very difficult for a while, and I'm afraid that in the end the person discovered that I have a friendship that excludes marriage. However, I believe our secret is safe." If a censor bothered to read this far, he would now conclude that the letter was from a lesbian to her lover. The same conclusion would be reached by anyone in England who read the letter. This hardly mattered. Undoubtedly Maud, being a feminist and apparently single at 26, was already suspected of sapphic tendencies. "In a few days' time I will be in Stockholm, another cold city beside the water, and you could send me a letter at the Grand Hotel there." Sweden, like Switzerland, was a neutral country with a postal service to England. "I would love to hear from you. Until then, my wonderful darling, remember your beloved Valtrud." 3. The United States declared war on Germany on Friday, April 6, 1917. Walter had been expecting it, but all the same he felt the blow. America was rich, vigorous, and democratic. He could not imagine a worse enemy. The only hope now was that Russia would collapse, giving Germany a chance to win on the Western Front before the Americans had time to build up their forces. 3 days later, 32 exiled Russian revolutionaries met at the Zaringerhof Hotel in Zurich, men, women, and one child, a 4-year-old boy called Robert. They walked from there to the Baroque arch of the railway station to board a train for home. Walter had been afraid they would not go. Martov, the Menshevik leader, had refused to leave without permission from the provisional government in Petrograd, an oddly deferential attitude for a revolutionary. Permission had not been given, but Lenin and the Bolsheviks decided to go anyway. Walter was keen that there should be no snags on the trip, and he accompanied the group to the riverside station and boarded the train with them. "This is Germany's secret weapon," Walter thought. 32 malcontents and misfits who want to bring down the Russian government. God help us." Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, known as Lenin, was 46 years old. He was a short, stocky figure, dressed neatly but without elegance, too busy to waste time on style. He had once been a redhead, but he had lost his hair early, and now he had a shiny dome with a vestigial fringe and a carefully trimmed Van Dyke beard, ginger-streaked with grey. On first acquaintance, Walter had found him unimpressive, without charm or good looks.
Walter was posing as a lowly official in the Foreign Office, who had been given the job of making all the practical arrangements for the Bolsheviks' journey through Germany. Lenin had given him a hard, appraising look, clearly guessing that he was, in reality, some kind of intelligence operative. They travelled to Schaffhausen, on the border, where they transferred to a German train. They all spoke some German, having been living in the German-speaking region of Switzerland. Lenin himself spoke it well. He was a remarkable linguist, Walter learned. He was fluent in French, spoke passable English, and read Aristotle in ancient Greek. Lenin's idea of relaxation was to sit down with a foreign language dictionary for an hour or two. At Gutmadingen, they changed again, to a train with a sealed carriage specially prepared for them, as if they were carriers of an infectious disease. Three of its four doors were locked shut. The fourth door was next to Walter's sleeping compartment. This was to reassure over-anxious German authorities, but it was not necessary. The Russians had no desire to escape. They wanted to go home. Lenin and his wife, Nadia, had a room to themselves, but the others were crowded four to a compartment. So much for egalitarianism, Walter thought cynically. As the train crossed Germany from south to north, Walter began to sense the force of character beneath Lenin's dull exterior. Lenin had no interest in food, drink, comfort, or possessions. Politics consumed his entire day. He was always arguing about politics, writing about politics, or thinking about politics and making notes. In arguments, Walter noted, Lenin always appeared to know more than his comrades and to have thought longer and harder than they, unless the subject under discussion was nothing to do with Russia or politics, in which case he was rather ill-informed. He was a real killjoy. The first evening, the bespectacled young Karl Radek was telling jokes in the next compartment. A man was arrested for saying, "Nicholas is a moron." He told the policeman, "I meant another Nicholas, not our beloved Tsar." The policeman said, "Liar, if you say moron, you obviously mean the Tsar." Radek's companions hooted with laughter. Lenin came out of his compartment with a face like thunder and ordered them to keep quiet. Lenin did not like smoking. He himself had given it up on his mother's insistence 30 years ago. In deference to him, people smoked in the toilet at the end of the carriage. As there was only one toilet for 32 people, this led to queues and squabbles. Lenin turned his considerable intellect to solving this problem. He cut up some paper and issued everyone with tickets of two kinds, some for normal use of the toilet, and a smaller number for smoking. This reduced the queue and ended the arguments. Walter was amused. It worked, and everyone was happy. But there was no discussion, no attempt at collective decision-making. In this group, Lenin was a benign dictator. If he ever gained real power, would he manage the Russian Empire the same way? But would he win power? If not, Walter was wasting his time. There was only one way he could think of to improve Lenin's prospects, and he made up his mind to do something about it. He left the train at Berlin, saying he would be back to rejoin the Russians for the last leg. "Don't be long," one of them said. "We leave again in an hour." "I'll be quick," said Walter. The train would depart when Walter